Listen, this morning we're going to continue our study in the Gospel of Mark. If you got a Bible or a Bible app or some way that you can go through and maybe make notations or take some notes, you'll want to find your way to Mark chapter 4, please. We've finished up a section, which was the first part of that chapter, where Jesus was telling stories, telling a lot of stories, a lot of agricultural stories, parables. And what he was doing through those parables was trying to teach us about how the gospel, the good news of God's inbreaking kingdom is at work in this world, how it works in this world. And last week we looked at how, you know, the gospel, this news of God's kingdom has an inherent power all of its own, that we've got a responsibility of scattering seeds and gathering people in, but the power behind all of that, that belongs to God. That's not going to be our ingenuity that makes that happen or anything happen. It's a matter of being available and ready to be there as God is at work. Now today, Mark is going to jump cut to another very dramatic scene. And remember, Mark's gospel is unique in that it's a narrative, but it's a different kind of narrative. It's not like a historical narrative. It's not so much a straightforward history. I believe it's a history. It's telling about us about real historic events. But it's written as a dramatic narrative. It was intended to be read in one setting as people gathered together to listen to this gospel. And it was more akin to like a play, like we would consider a play. And everything that happens in Mark's gospel happens quickly and for maximum dramatic effect. And so, you know, while we're still trying to puzzle through the last thing that just happened or was just said, pow, we're right into the next scene and the next events are unfolding. And so we're just kind of rolling along with this story. So much of Mark is intended to immerse us in the events that are taking place there, to get us asking questions. And that's one of the things that's delightful to me about Mark's gospel is that it provokes so many questions that it just refuses to answer. It requires us to answer those questions. And it draws us into the experience so that we kind of are experiencing these events right along with the characters that they're happening to. And this section that we're going to be reading today is a great example of what it is I'm talking about there. We're going to be reading a very familiar account of Jesus calming the storm. And if you've been around church for any length of time at all, you've certainly heard this story. You've heard it in Sunday school if you grew up in church. And while there are many, many ways in which we could approach this story, there's so many different elements to this. I don't know how many times I've actually preached this story, and I've never gotten, you know, I've never exhausted all the different ways that we could look at it. But this morning, I want to keep it thematically tied to what it is that we've just been looking at with the parables that Jesus was telling. And what I mean is that this, I believe this is an account of a miracle that really happened, that was done by Jesus, but I believe it's more than that too. And I believe that's the reason it's included in these things. It's a lived out parable that helps us to define what it means to follow this gospel seed that we've been talking about, what it means to follow this gospel, what it means to follow Jesus, who is the embodiment of heaven invading earth, what it means to us and what it's going to look like at times for us to be following this Messiah. Following Jesus is more than just listening to his stories. That's where we were. That's where we were as the story was going on, as the narrative unfolded. We were listening to Jesus tell stories, but it turns out there's more to it than that. It's more challenging than just mentally assenting to some proposed truth, you know, of just saying, yeah, I can agree with that. That sounds okay. And going about our merry lives. Following Jesus is usually way more than any of us bargained for. And that gets acted out in our text this morning as we look at it. So if you're there in Mark chapter 4, we're going to pick up where we left off, starting with verse 35. It says, as evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, let's cross to the other side of the lake. So they took Jesus in the boat and started out, leaving the crowds behind, although other boats followed. All right, I want to stop there for just a minute because right off the bat, we need to unpack some things and take a look at what's happening here in this text. To say that as evening came, is tying it to the events that we were just reading about. So in this same day, when Jesus is telling all these stories and all these crowds of people are gathering around him, you know, in the midst of this huge gathering, basically, that they've got, where people are attentive and he's telling things and truths are being revealed, Jesus suddenly says, hey, let's take a boat excursion and go somewhere else, which is typical of Jesus, if you think about it, when you think about the Gospels and how they unfold. He never seems to be willing to settle down into stasis. You ever notice that about Jesus? Even look at his miracles. He never repeats the same pattern. He never does the same thing twice. He's always, you know, doing something different in this. And I mean, you put yourself in the disciples' sandals for a moment as we think about how this is unfolding here. They got these big crowds coming to their meetings. You know, remember, Messiah fever, it's gripping Israel right now. The hope is that, you know, the king is going to show up and rally Israel to himself. And wonderful things are going to happen. They're going to overthrow the Roman Empire. All these wonderful things are going to take place. And so, you know, here they are. They're gaining this huge popularity among the locals there in Galilee. People are coming in droves. We saw how there was, you know, very little room for me to get out and preach out on a boat because there was just no room for him to even stand there as this was going on. And so, you know, they're hugely popular. These good things are happening. Everybody's, you know, the sentiment is definitely moving in his favor, swaying in his favor. Why would you ever want to leave there? I mean, this is awesome. This is what, you know, you look at what most churches are looking for. This is it. You know, we've got church growth going on. This is awesome. And you'd think, well, this is, you know, let's just settle down. Let's build a nice building right here in Galilee, and people can come from far and wide, and they'll gather here in this place, and Jesus will tell them how it is, and the crowds will come rolling in, and we'll, you know, get some real momentum going here. And Jesus says, hey, yeah, let's bail out of here. Let's go. That would have been hard enough, right? But then he says, let's go to the other side of the lake. And that is the real kick in the head for the disciples and all of those who are gathered around there. That's where things get really controversial. And you may think, well, what's the big deal? I mean, you go, why did the Messiah cross the lake to get to the other side? It's no big deal. Why would that be controversial? Well, here's the thing. Okay, so the Galilean region is on the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. That's where all the Jewish people are. Now, there's a lot of Gentiles in that area, way more than most Jewish people would prefer when you're talking about, you know, what they're looking for in a holy nation. But that's Jewish territory. It's still Israeli territory right over there in this area. So you see Capernaum, where Jesus has kind of got his headquarters. That's where he's been. And so this was, you know, a primarily Jewish area. But the other side of the lake, the east side, was Gentile territory. It was called the Decapolis. It was a region of 10 cities, Decapolis. And good, God-fearing Jewish people did not go over there. As a matter of fact, we've got writing sources from that time period that indicate that the rabbis of Jesus' day looked at that region of the Decapolis as being an extension of the ancient Canaanites that the Israelites had to drive out. They were just horrible. They were, you know, they were pagan, and they were doing terrible pagan things, and nobody would go over there, nobody who was good or respectable. And this is Jesus saying, hey, let's go to that place where good people say is off limits. Let's head over there real quick. And that is not the expected behavior of Messiah when he shows up. That's not what anybody was expecting. But this is the first thing we learn about following Jesus. It means that we're going to follow Jesus into unexpected places. You're going to search far and wide and in vain throughout the New Testament, or really even all the scriptures, to find a place where God puts any sort of premium on his people being comfortable. And I hate to break that to you, but that's a reality that's there in the scriptures. Jesus never once said to his disciples, take it easy. As a matter of fact, he said, take up a cross, but he never said, take it easy. He never said, you know, find a spot where you're comfortable and you feel good about everything and just stay there till I get back and we'll sort the whole thing out. No, just the opposite. Jesus seems to continuously be nudging us out of our comfort zones. And that's an ongoing thing because we know how it is. And this is, you know, this isn't like decrying us as human beings. This is just part of human nature. This is, you know, as human beings, we prize being comfortable. I mean, if you're going to sell something in this world, you're not going to sell it on the basis of it's anything except that it's comfortable. This is going to make you way more comfortable. This is what you want. The majority of our pursuits in life are to be as safe and, you know, to make life as predictable as possible. The majority of what we do, the majority of what we spend our money on is for that pursuit. We call it the pursuit of happiness, but what we're talking about is I want to be safe and comfortable and as manageable as life can be. We want to minimize risk. Most of, you know, we spend how much money on insurance to minimize risk? And then you find out after a hurricane, well, that didn't help. But anyway, we want, you know, some sense of security, or at least the illusion of security, hence insurance. But that carries over then into our pursuit of God. And we see that happen all the time. We want God to pretty much be in our image. I want God to be like me and be interested in the stuff I'm interested in. I only want God to be doing the stuff that I'm interested in doing, because otherwise, I don't like that idea. We want God's priority to be about something safe. Well, you know, surely this is all God would want for him. We decide that God's priority then is to, you know, listen to somebody talk about God for an hour once a week. And then we can just go about our normal lives and not have to think about this anymore, because honestly, that's a lot better. And when we gather, we want to make sure we gather with people who are as much like us as possible. Otherwise, everything gets, you know, way too uncomfortable. But this is the challenge. And this is the challenge that we're faced with in the Gospels all the way through. Jesus pretty much looks out from the text, looks at each one of us and says, let's go someplace uncomfortable. Let's go somewhere else. Let's get out of this comfortable situation. Let's go somewhere else. Let's go across the lake somewhere. Let's go next door and talk to your neighbors about the hope that you have. How about that? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? No, that's not interesting at all. That's frightening and disconcerting, and I would rather not, Jesus. Thank you very much. But he's kind of a nag when it comes to that. He's constantly pushing at us. Let's go. Let's go across the lake. Let's go. And so then we have to sit and think about this. Who are the people on the other side of the lake? I mean, who are they? It may be different for each one of us, but even on a cultural level, there's all kinds of people on the other side of the lake that we have to realize Jesus is here, right here this morning, saying, hey, let's go. Let's go across the lake. Let's go talk to that person that everybody else is avoiding because they seem like they're a little bit off. Let's go talk to him. I don't know, Jesus. No, come on, let's go. Let's go talk to that couple that everybody seems to be excluding because they're of the same sex. Yeah, but Jesus, people say that's off limits. Yeah, I know. Let's go. Yeah, but that could stir something up. Yeah, I know. Let's go. Let's go across the lake. I mean, imagine what Jesus is stirring up in this text here by going across the lake, by doing this. This is Jesus acting out what he's described in parable about scattering seed everywhere and indiscriminately. And if we're going to follow Jesus, we're going to have to get in on that activity. It's going to have to be more than just sitting around and listening to stories that Jesus tells. It's going to be about stepping into the boat with him and heading over to the other side of the lake. We're going to have to find ourselves in situations and with people that we didn't expect, that we wouldn't have expected in a million years. And I wonder if Jesus isn't surprising us this way, if Jesus, you know, isn't kind of popping up in our lives in ways that are unexpected to us or putting us in situations where we feel somewhat uncomfortable, I wonder if maybe we're just following religious expectations and not necessarily the Jesus of Mark or the rest of the Gospels. I mean, I don't know. I'm just wondering. If our experience with following Jesus has always landed us in very comfortable places, maybe we have to ask, are we really following Jesus? It's a question. I'm not answering it. I'm just saying it's a question to think through. So Jesus tells these guys, let's go to the other side of the lake. Let's go to unclean Gentile territory. Let's go. So everybody gets in the boat. They head out and a few other boats. Interesting how like not a flotilla follow them. A few other boats like, yeah, we'll go. And they get in the boat and they head out. This meant that they were unstable in the boat. I don't know why. But either way, verse 37. But soon a fierce storm came up. High waves were breaking into the boat and it began to fill with water. Jesus was sleeping at the back of the boat with his head on a cushion. The disciples woke him up shouting, teacher, don't you care that we're going to drown? OK, Okay, we'll stop here for a minute. So there it is. You know, Jesus goes to the place where it's off limits. You're not supposed to go. And a storm comes up and he's facing the retribution for this. I mean, it's as clear as possible, right? He's facing all this trouble because he's going where he shouldn't be. And I could easily imagine the disciples thinking along those lines. Couldn't you? I mean, could you kind of even imagine yourself thinking along those lines? Well, see, this is clear. We're not supposed to be here. I knew it. I knew he was going too far over here. In so many ways, it's interesting. This story mirrors the story of Jonah. If you take your time and look at it and put them side by side, it's amazing how much they mirror each other, except it's the exact opposite of the Jonah story. This storm is not the result of running away from God. This is happening as they're following God's path as laid out for them by Jesus. There's an important lesson for this in this, because to follow Jesus, it means that sometimes we're going to follow Jesus into unexpected places, into unexpected chaos in those places. The Jewish people, you know, they were not a seafaring people. They didn't, you know, they weren't like the people of Tyre and Sidon or the Phoenicians. Those guys loved living on the sea, you know, big surf community there, whatever. But for them, for the Jewish people, large bodies of water and the storms and the monsters that come from them become the shorthand language of describing the chaos that comes about in this life. From the creation story in Genesis to the crossing of the Red Sea, to the story of Jonah, to the apocalyptic literature of Daniel and Revelation, we always see that the, you know, storms at sea and the monsters that come from the sea, that's representing all that rises against the creative order of God. It's representative of this fallen world and the things that emerge from it. And we're people who know very well what it's like to go through the chaos that emerges from a storm that comes off of the sea. And we're still living in the aftermath of that. And for the Jewish people, that was very troubling indeed. That was representative of something they wanted nothing to do with. And I've said before, I believe this is an event that literally happened, but these stories carry deeper meanings to them than just being entertaining stories about Jesus's, you know, miracles. The buried in these stories are pictures of the lives that we lead. They reveal to us what it's like to step out into this life of following Jesus. The storm that Jesus and the disciples faced represent the chaos of this world that seems to spring on us suddenly and unexpectedly. And the biggest lesson that we want to take from this is that storms just happen. They happen in this broken world. This chaos wasn't the result of doing anything wrong. Nobody did anything wrong. This is Jesus, remember. I mean, this is just the stuff of a broken world. It's just here. It's the chaos that rises up against God's created order, against the order that God intends. And I've talked about this before at length, but it's so important for us as followers of Jesus to let go of these fairly pagan notions of, you know, that anytime a storm pops up in life, anytime something goes wrong or happens really bad, a little chaos hits us, we're somehow immediately assuming, oh, God's punishing me or God's trying to do this. We try to assign that to other places. You know, storms hit everywhere else. Well, you know, God's probably judging them because of what they did. And then a storm hits us and we're like, what happened? But there's the thing, you know, we're so quick to try to assign these things, and these things happen. They happen to Jesus as he's going off about doing Jesus's work. You know, sometimes we just get these, and I'm going to say it again, it's a very pagan notion of God, of, you know, of constantly being, you know, attacked with different things. And granted, listen, that's not to dismiss the idea altogether that sometimes God will use circumstances in order to get our attention, right? I mean, Hebrews 12 kind of indicates that to us, that God's going to correct us at times. Never punitively, never punitively. If we belong to Jesus and have placed our faith in him, God is not going to be punishing us. It's never a punitive thing, but sometimes a corrective thing will happen. You know, something comes along, God's wanting to get us focused, but I still insist that if that is the case, we're going to know what it's about. We're going to know why this is happening. It's going to come to us right away. You know what? I think God's trying to get my attention on this. I need to kind of pay attention to what I'm doing and how I'm living or whatever it is. If there are circumstances God is trying to speak to us through, we will recognize the voice of God in that. We're going to know what it's all about. God is not trying to torture us. He's trying to shape us. And if you know, he can't shape us if we don't know what's going on, or we don't know what things are about. So if all of a sudden we're hit with something and we're thinking, oh no, I must have done something. Oh no, I've made God mad, or something along those lines. We're not being shaped at all. We're just kind of being conformed to a pagan notion of fear that was not God's intention at all. We have to remember, listen, honestly, I would still say that even in my own experiences, those storms in life that have hit, that have been intended to shape me, probably I would call the exceptions, because mostly we live in a fallen world that storms creep up in. It's prone to chaos. And storms, you know, that happen usually have nothing to do with us other than us finding our coping life through the process of it, seeking God for that coping life through that. Does that make sense? One time I was going to buy a truck. This is years ago, and I was going with somebody from church who knew a lot more about cars than I do. And so we headed out there to buy this truck, or to look at it, and he was going to explore it with me. And as soon as we pulled up to where the truck was, I mean, just out of nowhere, a thunderstorm just broke right over top of us. I'm pouring buckets of rain and lightning across the sky and thunder and everything like that. And my friend, you know, maybe it was a little... was maybe a little overly seeking spiritual things that were going on in life. He looked at me and he goes, is this a sign? Is this a sign that's happening right here? And I was looking at it that, and I said, I think this is a low pressure system. And I think that if there's a lesson to learn, it's wait till this passes and then we'll look at the truck. And I bought that truck. I drove that truck for years. It had nothing to do with that storm. Sometimes storms just happen. Chaos happens. And in this story, chaos appears, and what's really interesting is chaos appears, but Jesus seems to be absent in it. He's sleeping aft, and how he's able to do that, I have no idea. That's a miracle in itself, but it may indicate, you know, he's fully human, may just indicate how extremely exhausted he was. He's been ministering nonstop, doing all this stuff. That'll take it out of you. And so, you know, he fell asleep, and he's sleeping through the waves rolling over the boat. And so the disciples, they cry out, and they cry out to him in a way that mirrors the Psalms. They're crying out, I cry to you in my distress. Where are you, Lord? They're saying, don't you even care? Don't you even realize? You see how this story is describing what it is to live this life of following Jesus. It describes our lives. Chaos hits, and there are these times when it just seems like Jesus is nowhere to be found. We pray, we feel like we're just praying to the ceiling. We don't feel like anything's going anywhere. We feel like we've been forgotten and abandoned, but none of that is true. And that's what the story is trying to get across. And here the story takes another interesting turn. We'll pick back up in verse 39. When Jesus woke up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, "Silence, be still." And suddenly the wind stopped and there was a great calm. And then he asked them, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" So for a while there, I was reading a lot of stories about World War II, firsthand accounts of soldiers that went through the events of World War II. It just was one of those things. I couldn't get enough of it. You know, they had been described as the greatest generation, and I wanted to know, you know, what made them that? What caused them to be able to tackle these huge odds of this worldwide conflict that was going on? And what made them so special? You know, how did they fearlessly storm those beaches and attack those strongholds the way that they did? And of course, I learned very quickly that they were not at all fearless. In these memoirs that I would read, one of the most common memories that these guys would share was this ongoing sense of dread and fear that they had to deal with on a daily basis, day and night. They never escaped it. It's just that they were people who accomplished what they did in spite of their fear, as all soldiers do in any kind of conflict. They were able to accomplish their goals even though they were beset with the kind of fears that they were. And I thought about that when it comes to this passage, because this is a strange turn in the story to me. Like, having just calmed the storm, Jesus looks at his disciples and he doesn't say, "Well, there you go, it's all clear. Let me get back to sleep here," or something like that. No, he challenges them and says, "Why were you afraid?" And it's so much worse in the Greek, because in the Greek, the word that he uses there is, it means to be cowardly or craven or a deserter from like a military type service. It should have really been translated, "Why are you guys such chickens?" And that's just kind of brutal, I feel like. I mean, I don't know, Jesus, you were asleep and the boat was taken on water and we were about to sink and none of us swim very well. Anyone with any sense would have been afraid in this situation. And Jesus, he calls them out on that. You know, where's your faith? And this is a troubling lesson that we have to learn about what it means to follow Jesus, because his challenge to them reminds us that we're actually following Jesus into unexpected expectations. There are things that Jesus is expecting from us that are not necessarily going to come naturally to us in this. Like I said, it's troubling to me at least. I mean, we have to ponder this a little bit. When Jesus says this to these guys, why were you chickens? Why don't you have any faith yet? Was he just being a jerk in this? Was he being unreasonable? Is the lesson here that we're supposed to, you know, be above any sort of fear for what's going on in life? Are we supposed to be like superheroes, just steely-eyed and unmoved by anything that comes our way? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I believe Jesus is calling out their fear, not because being afraid in a situation like this was wrong. It's not. It's very reasonable. It's very human to feel fear. He was calling out the way they handled their fear. And there's the distinction in that. Because the way they managed their fear showed, if not a lack of faith, a misplaced faith. Jesus asked them why they don't have any faith, but he's speaking of something specific in this. Obviously, they've got faith. They got faith that the boat is going down. They have faith that they're going to drown in this situation. The real question is where they're putting their faith. They put their faith in the chaos that was there. They believed that the chaos was the greatest power, and the reason they believed that is because they knew that this chaos was not something that they could stop with their own strength, and there we get to the heart of the problem. That's the real issue. Jesus isn't calling us to be superheroes. Superheroes, they put their faith in themselves because they're superheroes. I mean, that's what they do. But we, on the other hand, are called to put our faith in God. Not in our own abilities or in our own strength or on our own ingenuity. We're called to this fundamental trust that God knows, that God cares, and that God can act on our behalf. If the disciples could have just known it, could have been able to see the end of the story like we've been able to see, they'd realize this is a brilliant piece of foreshadowing to the very end of this gospel, where another storm comes up in the form of the Roman Empire, and Jesus, instead of sleeping in the boat, is hanging on a cross, and everything seems hopeless and lost, but it's not, because God knows, God cares, and God's got something in the works. In verse 38, when the disciples go to Jesus, it may have been different had they said, you know, Jesus, this storm is really bad and the boat is taking on water, but we know you're going to have an answer. So what should we do? What should we do here? Where are you at work in this situation? Instead, they wake up Jesus and scream, we're going to die. And you don't seem to care. See, Jesus wasn't expecting them or us to stand in some heroic pose and moved by all these storms in life. He simply calls us to manage our fears by knowing that he's here, that he's present, that he is at work in these things, and that he cares, and to put our hope in all the possibilities of that. I don't believe we're called to be fearless or to have no doubts. You know, oftentimes we think in terms of courage as the absence of fear, but it's not, as we talked about before. I don't believe faith is the absence of doubt, but I do believe we're called to face our fears by knowing that someone greater than our fear is present. And his presence makes all the difference. His presence carries with it all the possibilities of what God can do in any given situation. Someone is there to act on our behalf. All right, well, let's finish up reading verse 41. The disciples were absolutely terrified. Who is this guy? They asked each other. Even the wind and waves obey him. And that's where we're going to stop today. But this is fascinating to me. So the disciples go from fear to terror in this story. You'd think that the story would be that, you know, Jesus calms a storm and they go, woo, we're saved. And everybody's happy and they head on, you know, on their boat trip, you know, or whatever. But this isn't a comic book. This isn't a superhero story. These were real people who had certain ideas about Jesus being this, you know, cool prophet or empowered healer or really skilled teacher. What they didn't expect was this: a demonstration of power that took the reins of creation itself in a way that only God could do. This was like an oh shoot moment. Who is this guy? That's the question. Sorry. I don't want to offend the younger. But the question, who is this guy, is the underlying question that Mark is proposing through this entire story. That's what this is all about. It's, you know, he begins with the answer of who this Jesus is. He ends it as a Roman centurion, just blurts out the answer. But in between, this question hangs in the air. Who is this guy? Who is this Jesus? What are you going to make of him? What are you going to do with this? What are you going to do if he is who he says he is? That's what's underlying this. I love verse 41. It's just so real. After everything that had them so fearful is now calmed and abated, they experience another kind of fear altogether. The fear that comes from thinking they knew where they were when suddenly the lights go on and they realize they're not in the same place at all that they thought they were in. It's something that we have to keep in mind because it illustrates for us something that's very potentially troubling but exciting about following this Jesus into life. And that is that when we follow Jesus, we're going to follow him into an unexpected reality. This whole section is about an exchange of realities. He called the disciples out on a boat, away from the familiar territory of Galilee, off into this unfamiliar reality of the Decapolis. He's calling them to place their trust differently from the rest of the world. He's revealing to them a kingdom that is wildly different from what they had expected or even wanted a kingdom to be like. And all of this crystallizes in this holy terror as they realize that the one calling them to this radical kind of change very well may be the Creator God himself there in their midst. And in that moment, we can see the wheels turning as they're asking the question, who is this guy? Because they know in a flash of terrifying insight that this miracle is going to change them forever. This changes everything. This isn't something you go through and just say, wow, that was cool. Let's go get breakfast. It wasn't something that's going to just, you know, be a blip on the radar of their life experiences. This miracle changes everything for them. And I think that frightens them as well. Because we as human beings do not appreciate that kind of change. I remember when I asked Robbie to marry me, and I mean, we were just kids. I mean, we were in our early 20s, and, you know, we sat out in her VW Bug, and I asked her if she'd marry me, and, you know, after a few negotiations there, she finally said yes. And, you know, it was one of the, I can still remember, I mean, I'm walking on a cloud, I'm walking back into my house. I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And I sat down on the couch in my apartment, and I sat there, and I started thinking, I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And the weight of the realization of what I had just done was really coming, and I was terrified. And listen, I don't mean I was terrified of her, or that I was questioning about whether or not I loved her, but I suddenly started picturing what this meant to me as a human being. You know, and I started wondering, am I a good enough man to be her husband? Can I provide like I should? And man, if we have kids, am I going to be able to take care of them or be a good father? And on my thoughts, you know, were just going on because my reality had suddenly changed. Things were not the way they had been before. I had stepped into an entirely different world. And it changed me. I would say it changed me way for the better. I always say I'd be living in a cardboard box somewhere if it weren't for my wife, Robbie. But the reality is it changed me, and it was a good kind of change. But this is true when it comes to our following of Jesus. There comes a time, a moment, maybe even a miracle in our life. I certainly can point back to a period of time in my life when I realized this is for real. This is real. This is Creator God himself laying claim to my heart. This is not just life as usual. Something else is at work here. God's kingdom has come to earth, and it's here in my heart blossoming outward from there. This is huge. This changes everything. And listen, change can be scary. That can be, unsettling. But God's intent is for that change in our lives to be transformative, to be redemptive, to be healing. So let's embrace the possibilities and the reality of God's kingdom at work in our hearts and in this world. Let's embrace this new reality. Let's allow that reality to change the way we perceive ourselves, the way we perceive the others in the world around us, to let go of this us versus them mentality of this broken world and embrace the possibilities of this amazing mission we've been called into to share the hope of this good news that God is coming to set all things right through Jesus Christ. Let's join Jesus in this mission to bring order to the chaos of this broken world, to bring light and life to places where darkness and death have oppressed it. Let's follow Jesus into these unexpected places and into unexpected chaos at times, but let's trust his presence and his power to make the difference in our lives and in this world. Let's live in this new reality where he lives. Let's live like this world's already been made a better place. Let's demonstrate that reality in the way that we treat each other, in the way that we care for the broken and the lost and the marginalized of this world. Let's invite others into this hope that we have of Creator God himself setting everything right. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please? Stand up with me, please. Stand up with me, please. Stand up with me, please. Stand up with me, please.